will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
People said, well, don't sweat the small things. Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another in our series regarding the history of Silicon Valley. We're delighted to have you back. We're now approaching what we say was the early 90s in Silicon Valley and what it was like. So with me today is Peter Marchetti, who's a friend of mine and is a banker, private wealth banker, and then Guy Smith, who is my director of marketing for Tough Things First. So welcome, you two.
Great to be back.
Likewise, Ray.
Well, listen, let's get going here. Talking about some of the things that you guys are interested in regarding the history of Silicon Valley and as we now approach the 90s.
I actually had a question coming out of the last podcast. We're going through this period of tremendous growth and through the 80s and into the 90s. And I'm kind of wondering, basically, who were the folks that were, in your mind, kind of pushing forward the leadership or pushing forward the change and really leading the whole industry into like this massive period of growth? Who were the personalities and the people that were really like making Silicon Valley what it was during that period?
Fairchild was kind of falling off the rails. They were not all that doing that well. They were being acquired by National Semiconductor and then later spun back out again. National was doing, okay. There were, growing quite rapidly, and they did acquire at that point a Fairchild Semiconductor. The ones that I really admired or thought were kind of my peers, Jack Gates at Maxim Integrated Circuits, Bob Swanson at Linear Technology. They were my two closest rivals, as they say, but I admired both of them. They were both heading in a slightly different direction. Maxim started out basically leaving Intersil. Jack Gifford left Intersil, took a team of guys with him, analog type guys, and he was going to approach doing analog circuits using CMOS. Bob Swanson left National and took a real good team of guys with him, and they were going to do it with more traditional bipolar technology. And it was interesting, both of them are quite successful in the way they pulled out of their respective companies, Swanson leaving National and then Gifford leaving Intersil. This all took place in the early 80s. So we're kind of going back a little bit, but both of them had raised about $20 million apiece from venture capital individuals, but they had both done very, very well. They ultimately went public at about the same time I did in the early 90s, which we'll talk about. So I was interested in watching them and kind of mirroring what they were doing from an analog point of view, because that was, our expertise. So I did admire both those individuals. Also, I thought Bob Noyce was doing quite well at Intel, and I admired him for what he was able to accomplish. But the Troika, as we referred to him, was really my company, Mike Krell, Maxim Integrated Circuits, and Linear Technology. We were the high flyers. We were the ones that were doing quite well, we're competing for good designers. So that was kind of the landscape back in the 80s, as you would. And from outside the industry, I admired Jack Welch at GE. I thought he was a pretty good leader and had done a great job in guiding GE. Interestingly enough, GE had acquired Intersil. And so here we have Jack Gifford leaving Intersil and founding Maxim, and which I thought was a kind of GE just kind of let them go. They just really didn't fight much to let them leave Intersil. Where on the other hand, when Bob Swanson left National, I mean, that was a real dogfight. I mean, I thought National was going to be able to bury a Linear Technology because that lawsuit had cost over $11 million at that point. And then trying to just fighting, as you would, the legal battle over, you know, confidential designs and so forth. So Gifford got to leave Intersil pretty unscathed, as you would, again, taking a good group of designers. And then Swanson leaving National, but National put up a heck of a fight, whereas GE just kind of let Intersil go, or let Jack Gifford and his team of guys go. So hopefully that kind of answers your question, Peter.
Yeah, that's great, Ray. I mean, it's just good to know some of the background and the people that you knew and, you know, and you felt were good competitors in the space.
Okay, so let's move into the kind of where the industry was into the early 90s. So I think Linear Technology and Maxim went public just before I did. I think they went public in somewhere between 92 and 93, 1992, 93. So they preceded me. Both of them had done well. I mean, they were venture capital funded, whereas Micrel was not. We only had, you know, $300,000 original investment in Micrel compared to their $20 million.
And on that, Ray, if I could stop you for a second, why is that? Why were they venture backed and you weren't?
Well, I mean, they start out, they didn't have to make money. I decided to become bank funded using bank debt to start my company. And I had to be profitable. That was a requirement from the bank, was if I was going to be funded by them, that I had to be profitable. So I couldn't just start out losing money like Maxim and LTC could lose money. They lost a ton of money when they started the company. Again, they had $20 million they raised compared to my $300,000. I mean, just think about that for a minute. I mean, that's a huge difference. So I had to go a little slower and do it a little differently, running the company profitably from day one, and they didn't have to. So another interesting thing, back in that time frame, to go public, you only had to be profitable. You had to be profitable for at least three straight quarters. And that was interesting because nowadays you don't have to be profitable to go public. But back in my time, back in the 90s, you had to be profitable.
Some people would say that being profitable nowadays going public might actually be a hindrance to you with some of the numbers.
Well,
right?
They couldn't go public. Okay. So, but back in the early 90s, you had to be profitable for at least three quarters. I was profitable from day one. So we had no problem. In fact, I had a lot of pressure from my employees to take the company public. It going back as early as 1986. So, I mean, they were bugging me. Oh, they wanted these. Oh, we need to have liquidity. And it was really a lot of pressure on me to take the company public, which finally we did in 1994. At that point, LTC and Maxim had already gone public. And so here we are, we're a little later. You know, but as Orson Welles said, no wine before its time. And so, you know, I didn't think we were ready to go public. I didn't want that responsibility of being public, but from pressure from my employees and so forth, we decided to go ahead and take the company public. Because you have to remember, I'm trying to hire designers. And so, you know, LTC and Maximum were able to go public, and those guys had liquidity. Whereas in my case in 1994, you know, my people didn't have liquidity. And so it's difficulty hiring a good designers.
How did you get people then when you're matching up against other companies that can offer options and liquidity and something that's maybe a little bit more tangible financially? How did you compete?
Well, we did offer stock options. They just weren't public. In other words, they were privately held, but they did get stock options, and they got good ones too. They got better stock options in the anticipation at some point we'd go public. So we were able to offer very good options, better than LTC and Maximum were offering. The difference is they had liquidity and we didn't. So we offered good stock options, very good stock options. They like working for Mike Krell because we were a good company and we were very competitive. We were competitive with both LTC and Maximum. So we're getting quite a name for ourselves. Come 1994, in December 1994, we decided that we were prepared and ready to go public. And so it's not that I wanted to go public at that point, it's just that, you know, with the pressure of my employees and the pressure of the board kind of the environment that we were in back in the early 90s, we decided to go ahead and take the company public. Now, I'd wanted to go public at some point, but I thought it was still a little bit early. I wanted to go public more like in 98, 99. So we were about 4 years earlier than I wanted to. But the good thing is that when we did go public at a good stock price, a reasonable one, we didn't have to raise a lot of money because Mike Krell didn't need a lot of money because we were a good cash flow positive and we had lots of cash. So we raised as little as we could in the public market, so we didn't have to give up a lot of ownership of the company to do so. Talking historically, where a lot of companies' stock price dropped below their IPO price at some point in their life cycle, we didn't. Our stock price never did drop below our IPO price, and that was always something we used to tout and we're proud of.
This gets to what I think is a split with inside of Silicon Valley on the subject of leadership. We were talking earlier about the 1980s. Bill and Dave were still wandering around the Hewlett-Packard headquarters at that time. They had your view about the longevity of a company, about it being an enduring enterprise, not a bottle rocket company, as you have called them before. And they didn't make hard, fast moves. But during the 1980s, they were growing like a weed, innovating the mini computer market, taking over the personal computer market, basically inventing and reinventing from the ground up the whole printer market, whether it was IT or desktop. And so you took that kind of approach when it came to the IPO and moving your company forward. It was much more of a measured response instead of the prototypical Silicon Valley jump through every ring of fire you can to move as fast as you can. Talk about that a little bit, because this is part of Silicon Valley history, you know, the difference between what you called the bottle rocket companies and the hoist companies.
Bill Hewlett and David Packard called it the HP way. And, you know, that's the model. This is the HP way. And so we adopted that saying at Mike Krell. We call it the Mike Krell way, which is to be profitable no matter what, to make sure that we had longevity as opposed to just in and out, as they say. And I did compare my company, Mike Krell, to a hoist. You know, if you go to a garage and watch them lift a car up, it's not too exciting. Not a lot of people go in to watch somebody lift the car off the ground, but a hoist can lift a very heavy object off the ground and sustain it for long periods of time. Whereas in a bottle rocket or fireworks, they go screaming upward. Everybody wants to see them. They're glorious to watch and they're wonderful, but they fizzle out. And then what do you have? It's just you know, not, it's not very enduring, as they say. So we always promoted Micrel is always profitable, enduring, you know, lasting forever, you know, solid as a rock, and being the Micrel way, similar to Bill Hewlett and David Packard talking about the HP way. And HP was highly, highly admired back in the 80s, highly admired. And they did a lot of acquisitions, some of them okay, some of them not so good. And it kind of got them off in a different direction, as you pointed out, Guy, into the mini computer market, which was the big thing back in those days. They also did, you know, consumer calculators, you know, scientific and financial calculators. They built a lot of, you know, like watches. They came out with the first smartwatch, as they say. You could have a little computer on your wrist, and that was the HP wristwatch. It was pretty big. I mean, it's pretty massive, but it was the first one. They were getting into consumer electronics, and I'm not sure that was the best move on their part, but they did do it. I mean, it's a different approach. So with that, guys, let's close this segment of the history of Silicon Valley out. And we'll invite everybody to come back, and as we move forward into the 90s, and hopefully talk a little bit about what Silicon Valley looked like in the 1990s, and go from there. So thanks again for being with us, Pete and Guy, for being here with us today. Grateful for your support. Please read my book, Tough Things First, as well as my new book, Zen of Zen. And we have a new one coming out called Zen of Zen 2 that'll come out shortly, probably in the next 4 or 5 months. And we're also contemplating doing a history of Silicon Valley, excerpts from these podcasts that we're doing. So please join us again. Grateful to have you here with us. And we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.